Welcome, 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 geeks and nerds, girls and boys, to a brand new edition of Geek to Me Radio, episode 256. Today we'll be talking with producer-director Joel Soisson about his brand new movie, My Best Worst Adventure, as well as several of his other projects he's done throughout his career. We'll then speak with gaming legend Walter Day all about the foundation of video games and where the future of video games and esports may be going. Stand by.
We're talking TV, comics and movies, and video games. And if you don't know Star Trek from Star Wars, we'll try to explain.
And for those of you who may be finding our show for the very first time, welcome to you. I'm your host, James Enstall. Each time on Geek to Me Radio, we try to bring you someone new from the world of TV, movies, video games, or comic books. Someone you might enjoy hearing about their career and new projects they've got. For those longtime listeners, thank you very much for tuning in once again to this episode of Geek to Me Radio. Two fantastic interviews this hour. Let's dive right in.
Right now we're talking with writer, director, producer Joel Soisson about his career in Hollywood, specifically about his brand new film, My Best Worst Adventure, on which he is the writer and director. Joel, how are you?
I am doing pretty well, thanks.
Good. Yeah, thank you for the time today. Lot to talk about. I want to start with the new film that's out, My Best Worst Adventure, streaming on most digital platforms on September the 1st. Looking over your career as a writer and director and producer, you've got a lot of variety in there. What drew you to this project? What made you kind of want to take this on and write it, and kind of the impetus behind telling this story?
Well, I have done a lot of, some people might say, too many horror films for any human being to be saddled with. And you know, I like the genre. I like, you know, I've done teen comedies and action films and horror films and pretty much everything in the genre. But there's an artifice to that. There, you know, it's still kind of disconnected from real people. You're setting up gags and plot driven, and I really was just yearning to do something with real human beings in a really fascinating but real situation, and where there's some comedy and some action and even some horror, but it's all reality based. And that was the impetus. And I was doing a little horror thriller in Bangkok, and just happened to be talking to the producer, a woman named Charyawan Tavoranon. And she just happened to tell me about, you know, her life as a kid growing up near the Cambodian border in a tiny little village. And they used to race water buffaloes. And I mean, it's insane, because I mean, these things are stampeding bulls that, you know, with horns and everything, and they go as fast as a sprinting horse, and they're riding bareback and falling off all the time and just trying not to get trampled. And that's great time for them. And it became a national sport, and they have their, you know, superhero sports racers now, and it's a thing. And I just thought it would be really interesting to see what happens when a sort of an alienated girl from LA just drops down into that world as if she was landing on another planet, and see what ensues. And it was a great time just trying to puzzle all that out.
And that scene where they're racing, and you know, the kids are on the water buffaloes, and they kind of almost befriend that one. I'm an animal lover, so now you've made me want a water buffalo for a pet. My dog might be upset, yeah, but it'd be very cool to have one. It was such a cool scene.
They are wonderful animals. And the thing that I loved about, you know, filming in Southeast Asia, where, you know, there's a lot of people, you know, talk about cruelty to animals in other countries that don't respect them the way we do. Well, these guys are so, so different. They're family members, these buffalo. And, I mean, they're like horses plus. And the care that they give to them, because they're their livelihoods. I mean, these rural families, they subsist on the power that they give them, the agriculture, everything, comfort, their pets too. And that way of life is going away now that their tractors and all this other stuff that supplants the water buffalo, these guys now have to give them up. And it's heartbreaking.
And having sadly never been to Southeast Asia myself, filming in a rural location like that for this movie, My Best Worst Adventure, is it any different really than filming in like rural Nebraska? Is there still like you have to go a ways, but there's a Walgreens if you need batteries for the camera or something like that? Did it present its own unique set of challenges filming in this location?
Absolutely. And the fun thing about filming in the United States, even the most remote little backwater in the U.S., you're still bringing Hollywood to it. So, you know, everything is oriented around creature comforts, you know, and
right.
and even most of the first world, wherever you wind up shooting. But here we were shooting an entirely Thai crew and many, many locals. And we basically subverted our own sort of cultural biases, I guess, to just immerse ourselves in the process. It was more safari than film in a way. And that's what I got the most of kick out of, because I really felt that I was a part of the culture by the end.
It's probably one of those things now you kind of want to make a sequel, if nothing else, just to go back and be able to film in that beautiful environment.
I know. It's just, well, I do and I don't. I came back. This is not everyone's experience. I don't want to turn anybody off from traveling to Thailand, which is the most beautiful country I've ever been to. But I got a call from the county health board as soon as I landed, practically, because I had sort of a funky stomach a little bit, you know, like that travel thing that you get sometimes.
Yeah, sure.
And what I'd gotten was some parasite.
Oh no.
From the water or I don't know what it was, but it's one of those things that they jump on. This was just pre-COVID, so it wasn't even a COVID thing. They just like this thing, if it's transmitted and breaks out in LA and goes elsewhere, I'm become Typhoid Mary.
Ooh.
And I could be responsible. And like, they're like, who have you talked to? Who have you touched? Where have you eaten? Where have you touched food? Where they're like, oh boy, what do I have? They wouldn't even tell me what I had. It was like, which is not the best kind of introduction to the health guys.
No kidding.
And turned out it was relatively benign, you know, a couple pills and it was gone. But yeah, it was just a rough welcome back into the real world for sure.
And changing gears, you mentioned all the horror films you've done. I'm a big Dracula 2000 fan. I saw it, I think, three times in the theater. And when you look back, the cast you had in that, my goodness, you had Vitamin C, Shane West, you had Jennifer Esposito, Nathan Fillion, Gerard Butler was your Dracula way back before he was a huge, huge star. But having that amazing cast, that when you look back on it now, A, it's hard to think that was over 20 years ago, but B, that has to be one of the projects you look back on with a little bit of pride.
You know, I really did enjoy that film and the process of making it. And, you know, when Bob Weinstein, the kinder, gentler brother, came to me and said, you know, I want another Dracula film. I want a Dracula film. I just like, I don't know what to give you, man. That is just like such well-worn ground. And he goes, that's why I want you to do it. I want you to write it because you don't want to. And I don't want somebody who's just going to give me the same old thing. So I go, okay, what's my way into this? And I actually have to admit that my way into it was not something I came up with, but was our director, who said, well, what if, since they share the same kind of hatred of silver and anger at humanity and historical aversions to, you know, certain religious iconography and the whole blood thing. What if the origin of Dracula was that he was the biblical Judas?
Yeah.
And he's been damned never to be able to die. He tried to hang himself and it didn't work. And he now forever wanders the earth, repulsed by anything that resembles Jesus, his former friend and brother, and can only drink blood of human beings. And the silver bullet is obviously what does the most damage. And so, you know, and it all sort of linked together. And I just suddenly saw a whole tapestry that made it interesting for me, because it made Dracula human. It made him a hurt, sort of damaged person, besides being a scary monster.
Yeah, and then obviously, while I love Anthony Hopkins as Van Helsing, it doesn't get much better than Christopher Plummer either.
Yeah, Christopher was a good time. I mean, they all came bringing it, you know, and that's always fun when they really want to be there. So it was good. I just enjoyed those, and Jerry Butler is one of the most funny, fun human beings to ever hang out with. With the caveat being you have to be willing to stay up until the odd hours of the morning and be able to shoot the next day at 6 a.m. but otherwise, he is so cool.
And with the Prophecy films, too, that's another one. The original Prophecy I saw in the theater at least twice. Christopher Walken is just amazing. But you went in further and went on with that series, too. I mean, you were a producer on the original, but then you ended up writing, I believe, the third and the fourth, I think. Talk a little bit about sticking with that franchise and expanding upon the premise of the original.
Well, you know, I'm glad you brought that one up, because sequels are risky business. They're what William Goldman called horrors movies, and they can be if you don't have some reason to make a sequel.
Yeah.
Besides the money. And, you know, as much as I've had fun doing Children of the Corns and Hellraisers and have I ever written Halloween? I can't remember. I think I've been a producer on one or two, but they're just, there's only so much they can do except hide in a closet and come out and you know, slash you to ribbons. Right. And or chains or whatever. Prophecy was such a different approach to horror that it goes back to, of all people, John Milton and Paradise Lost, and the whole idea of Lucifer and God having a spat, which forced his favorite out of heaven and into what became hell, that was just the domain of God's best friend. And, you know, you can probably see a thematic prejudice on my part, because it's sort of what happened to Dracula too. He just like got screwed over by the good guy and
right.
decided to be the bad guy. But when you have the Bible underpinning the entire storyline, there's just so much to draw on, you know. There's so much biblical history and so many interpretations, and to have angels coming up to a human being going, What is this Nicene Council? What did they realize in 4 AD about the role of humans and angels and man? I mean, and God. And is it true that humans were elevated past angels in the eyes of God? And that question that just lingers in the whole movie, it's just about jealousy. And so you can do sequel after sequel on that. There's no end to it. I could give three new sequel ideas while we're talking on that and be just completely excited, as I am kind of getting now.
So would you like to announce here on the show that there'll be another Prophecy installment coming soon?
If I can scare up $45 and a iPhone, I'm going to do it, because that makes me happy. That kind of horror where you have to think about it.
Yeah,
a little bit.
Yeah.
And like, go, even God forbid, go, you go back to the Bible and go, is that really what happened? Or Paradise Lost, or some great literature or something. That's fun. And still people get speared and beheaded and run over by trucks and all the good stuff. But there's a reason for it. There's a meaning behind it. And I just really get off on that.
And just that line by Christopher Walken in the first one that kind of really sets the tone is, you know, I remember he's talking with Lucifer and he's like, why are you so upset? You know, Gabriel, why are you? And Gabriel said, because God doesn't talk to us anymore. And it's just that, yes, kind of like that gave me chills just thinking about the way Christopher Walken delivers that line, and that the movies, each movie was very well done. And it's not one of those ones where sometimes you do a sequel. There's a couple in the series. And it's kind of like, well, they're retreading the same ground. I felt like each one was unique in its own right. That's kind of why I love that franchise.
We'll take our first break, come right back and chat more with writer, director, producer Joel Soisson. Please stand by.
Hi, this is Barry Bostwick, and damn it, Janet, would you just keep listening and come back to Geek to Me Radio, will you?
I've one thing to say, and that's, damn it, Janet, I love you.
The road was long. Welcome back to Geek to Me Radio. Since we are talking movies with director-producer Joel Soisson, it would only be appropriate for me to take this time to tell you about our official movie sponsor here at Geek to Me Radio, Marcus Theaters. Marcus Theaters and Movie Tavern. You can go to the website, marcustheaters.com. Find the location closest to you. Check out the movies that are playing. A lot of great movies coming out. I know we just found out that a couple have been pushed back till next year. Hopefully that's not going to be a trend. Hopefully we still get some really great movies coming out, as we already have. If you haven't already seen Shang-Chi, go out and see that one. Fantastic opening weekend. It looked just over the 80 million mark for its opening weekend. Congratulations to the cast and crew of that movie. A lot of good movies to go see. Go see Free Guy. There's Don't Breathe Part 2. And we've got the fall season coming right up here soon. So we'll be able to see movies like Halloween and other stuff. It's never a bad time to go see a movie. I love movie theaters. I love the experience of going to the movies, getting the huge popcorn and the soda, the snow caps, or whatever your candy o choice is. You can also download the Marcus Theaters app. That way, if you're out and about and you say, hey, let's go see a movie today, you can find the location closest to where you are, get your tickets, even order your concessions right there through the app. So make sure you do that as well for a little added convenience. Check out the website once again, marcustheaters.com. Very proud to have them as the official movie sponsor here on Geek to Me Radio. And I always say it's the best movie going experience in the galaxy. Before we took that last break, we were chatting with director, producer Joel Soisson about one of the franchises he was involved in, the Prophecy series, and how much I loved that and got to hear his take on it as well.
Well, thank you. I'm glad you had checked that out, because that is one of my favorites for that exact same reason. And that exact same line is what knocked me out when I first read the script, because to have God's right-hand man, the guy that's carrying the sword of God in the Old Testament, and a trumpet, actually, but to turn around and go, he doesn't talk to me anymore, is heartbreaking.
Yeah.
And this is right before he's going to kill you. You know, it's just like, yes, I like that.
And you mentioned a lot of other horror things you've done, Children of the Corn, but also it just in your producing hat, stuff like Nightmare on Elm Street Part 2, Bill and Ted's Excellent Adventure, which is just like an iconic classic, documentary like Trekkies. So when you're looking at films to produce, obviously if you're writing and directing something, I always feel like the producers have to have a very special interest in a film. Talk a little bit about, as a producer, what makes you sit up and take notice on a film?
If I'm producing a film, it means I've fallen in love with the script, or somebody is paying me way too much money, because I don't really enjoy producing.
Oh, really?
As okay. As a job, it is at best you're an orchestra conductor who's getting all these great talent people together to make magic. And sometimes that happens where you just feel that thrill of just being a part of a creative just tsunami. Most of the time it's the food's cold, my trailer didn't show up, my clothes are too tight, and I'm supposed to be doing a bar mitzvah this Friday and I can't do my major scene. And it's just a constant stream of need. And anybody who is out there contemplating being a producer, I hope you're good at being a Cub Scout leader.
See, that's, a lot of people think that, oh, your producer must be very glamorous. And it, evidently the reality is not so much glamour.
Well, there are those producers. I'm rarely among them that basically sit outside a swanky cafe with their lattes and decide whether they want Tom Hanks or Christian Bale. And then they go home and they've done their producing job. But I don't get to be that guy. Most of the time I'm the guy going, why is Christian Bale so pissed off?
A little bit of a different feeling then. So obviously the writing and directing, you are involved in the artistic process. You're actually creating something. And that's obviously then another reason why it sounds like those be more exciting, more fun to do than producing.
All things being equal, yes, because instead of being the guy who sits on the thumbtack on the chair, you're the guy that gets to put the thumbtack on the chair as a writer, a director, for the producer to sit on. And it's always more fun. I mean, basically, if I were to really just completely distill it down to absurdity, the writer and director create problems and the producer solves them.
That's a great way to put it. Yeah. Makes it very simple and easy to think about like that. And you must have known from at a fairly early age that film and movies are kind of what you want to do. New York Pratt Institute for film and animation. Then you went to University of Southern California for film studies, American Film Institute for cinematography. So you don't do that kind of a commitment unless you know for a fact from an early age, I feel, that this is what you were meant to do or really want to do.
It's versions of that, absolutely. But I started off wanting to be a painter. That's why I went to art school. And then I thought animation might be the way to go. So I hopped over to LA to get into the Disney internship there, and then realized like drawing 24 frames a second all day long, year after year after year, was not my thing. Mm-hmm. And then getting into film then as like, okay, this merges art. It merges, you know, writing emerges. I've always been a visual guy. I really wanted to be a cinematographer. I'm still a frustrated cinematographer because nobody has ever let me pick up a camera.
Ah.
Which is probably a message of some sort. But so, yeah, it's just, I think we all share that same thing or we wouldn't be talking. There's just a love of the medium. I love to watch it. I love to participate any way I can. Even producing sometimes, and I love sitting in that dark theater afterwards and going, yeah, that all came together kind of.
Yeah, that's sitting in the dark theater. That's kind of like I started all my childhood there. I love watching movies and seeing movies. It's kind of been a cinephile ever since I was a very young age. And with my best worst adventure coming to streaming on September the 1st, with this one, where do you kind of? Are you already working on your next project? Are you kind of envisioning where you want to go next? Are you able to, once you finish a project like this one, do you shelve it and quickly move on? Or do you kind of linger a little bit before putting on the next project hat?
I would love to linger. The problem is that since I had a very nice 2020, you know, grieving and having, you know, the emotional roller coasters that we all did, but from a practical standpoint, I got to sit on my butt and just think about life and walk my dog and do real people stuff. Mm-hmm. And then as soon as the shutdown ended, I've got way too much to do. And then next month I'm starting a little Danny Trejo riff on the Magnificent Seven that I wrote, and am it's kind of a comedic sort of homage-y thing in Oklahoma. And then going on later in the year to South Africa to try to pull off a semi-remake of The Treasure of Sierra Madre. Oh, why wow. I'm on remakes now, I don't know. It's just happening. But those are kind of like keeping me up at night now. And I wish I could just sit and enjoy this part, which is just like talking about a movie I love. And by the way, if I'm not mistaken, I think we're on VOD first.
Okay.
September 1st. So you have to do that little QWERTY thing to find it on your local cable or TV or computer, however you do it. Don't watch it on an iPhone, damn it.
big screen, the biggest screen in your house.
Yes, whatever it is. And or else if you don't have one, put a sheet up outside and project it.
There you go.
So then shortly thereafter, it will be streaming, but I'm not sure the exact date. I've been told later in September sometime. So keep an eye out for it. But yeah, I'm looking forward to staying busy. I am getting into the gray zone of my career. So I don't know how much longer I want to be at this pace. I'd like to maybe slow down and maybe do one a year or less. Mm-hmm. But right now it's like it's the cinematic version of running with the bulls. So I'm up for it for the time being.
Got to make hay while the sun shines, as they say.
Exactly.
Well, it's been absolutely delightful to talk to you. And again, the movie is My Best Worst Adventure, video on demand on September the 1st. And then streaming after that, we'll keep an eye on it for those of you listening. And we'll put a link in the show notes so you can find it quickly once the sites are updated, like Amazon, if it's streaming there, or Hulu. We'll put links up as we go. Where can people find you if they want to keep up more with you on social media, on websites, things like that?
You know what? I'm on IMDb. I'm going to get there with Twitter. I'm not quite there yet. We have a Facebook page for My Best Worst Adventure and a Twitter page with one of those hashtaggy things in front of it. Not sure how that works, but that's about what we got so far. But we're building out on the social media level. Never been my biggest skill set.
It's hard yet to keep up with because there's a lot of platforms, and it seems like each one presents its own set of challenges.
I know. Well, I'm working on my TikTok profile now.
Perfect. So we can at least find you there, if nothing else.
Yes.
Joel Soisson, this has been absolutely great. I thank you for your time, and we will look forward to seeing My Best Worst Adventure next month.
Thank you so much, James. It's been a pleasure.
Thanks again to director, producer Joel Soisson. Make sure you check out My Best Worst Adventure. It's on digital as of September 1st. You can catch it. Look up for your streaming service to have that on there soon. Great film. I highly recommend checking that one out. We're going to take our next commercial break, come back, and chat with video game legend Walter Day. Please stand by.
Hey, this is Yuri Lowenthal, but you may know me recently as Peter Parker / Spider-Man, and you're listening to Geek to Me Radio.
Welcome back to Geek to Me Radio, the show that would not be possible without the support of our premier sponsor, and that is, of course, the City of St. Charles, the Greater St. Charles Convention and Visitors Bureau. It was a beautiful day. We're in Labor Day weekend. We just passed that by, and luckily we had some fairly decent weather, Sunday and Monday anyway, of it. Great time to get out. There were a lot of people out in St. Charles doing their thing and just getting out and enjoying the outdoors. Some of the patios were full, all the outdoor eating places. Tompkins House, Salt and Smoke, a lot of patio at Magpies, just brimming with people wanting to get out and enjoy the nice weather, eating outdoors. Because before you know it, the weather's going to start to cool down, which I like that chill in the air. I like that crisp fall air. And now that we're in September, one of the things you can count on and look forward to is Legends and Lanterns coming in St. Charles right around the corner. A great, great time. It's a full family event to bring everyone out to and enjoy the Halloween festival that goes on the middle three weekends of October. So you can go to the website, discoverstcharles.com, and check out the calendar of things there are to do. There's a great New Orleans-style Creole voodoo ball that's going to be coming up, headed up by some people as Baron Samedi and Marie Laveau, the voodoo queen of New Orleans. It'll be a great time. It's an added-on event. Everything else, though, during the festival is free. It's open. You can come out and interact with all the characters. They've got the Scarecrow Glen, where you can vote on the different scarecrows at the different stores and different places to put out there. It's a lot of fun to do that as well. Bring your kids in costume, too. Costumes are encouraged. Come out and hang out with some of these kooky characters like Phantom of the Opera or Igor from Frankenstein or Lizzie Borden and some of those other characters. The Queen of Hearts is fantastic. But come and check it out. Go to the website and kind of plan your trip. If you're listening and you're not in the greater St. Louis area, come visit us. It's a great place to visit. And if you are here, well, then you've really got no excuse. It's just a quick drive right across the bridge. But check out the website. That's your best place to start your adventure. DiscoverStCharles.com. That's DiscoverStCharles.com. As we always say, it's an historically good time. And with that said, I've got another great guest, very excited to talk to this next gentleman. So let's go ahead and get into the interview.
We're talking with Walter Day. If there's anyone who's more about video games, I'm not sure who that person might be. Walter, thanks for your time.
I'm honored. I'm honored to be on the show, just as I'm honored to be at the show, because this show is a pretty big show.
It is.
This show is a very significant show. I love the incredible, eclectic diversity of all the different kinds of themes that I hear, from cosplay to comics to whatever, to video games, especially video games. They're making a foray into video games year after year after year, and this is the culmination of their interest so far, with Clash, Old School Gamer Magazine, coming here from Iowa, from Des Moines, and setting up a booth and sponsoring a Classic Gaming Olympics, the World Championship. So I'm very pleased to be here, and I'd just like to say that there's something special about retro gaming.
Absolutely.
If you take your average kid who's playing the games that they're playing right now, in 5 years, that new younger generation that comes up will be playing a different set of games. And when the kids who were playing the games the 5 years ago still love those games, because people commonly continue to stick with the games they grew up with. And so the new generation will say, oh, you guys are retro gamers. The point I'm getting at is every single thing that you see in here, in this whole place, that is the new modern games, and not too many years from now, they will be retro games.
That's weird to think about.
Oh, yeah, because, and it's funny, and the new generation will sneer at the people of today. In 5 years, those people will sneer at the people today and think that they're old-fashioned retro gamers, because time marches on, culture just, you know, dips across time and space, and essentially, history is incorporating more and more and more gaming modalities, making it part of their incredible legacy and heritage. And that's what Old School Gamer Magazine is all about, that has sponsored me to come here. They like to embrace the incredible wide spectrum of history and bundle it all together under the expression Old School Gamer. So it's a very, very neat thing to watch, as more and more games, just like every year, a car that's 25 years old
right.
is then considered a classic. So where does that put us? 96 is 25 years ago?
Yeah.
So a 1994 car, which seems like yesterday, technically is considered a classic. And the same with the games. More and more of those games are creeping into the classic realm, and people aren't noticing. All they know is they love what they grew up with, and they usually stay devoted to those games, even more than going to the newer titles. And those newer title people think, oh, you're a classic gamer, a retro gamer. And that's just the way it's going. So three cheers for retro gaming, because retro gaming is a bigger deal than people realize, and it's part of all our lives.
It's interesting to think about, too, like you mentioned stuff like 94, 95, 96. That, to me, doesn't... I think like that decade between 2000 and 2010 didn't happen, because someone will say, 1996. Oh, that was just 10. No, that was 25 years ago. But you, as someone who has seen the changes throughout gaming, what's the biggest underlying trend that games have changed, consoles have changed, but something has stayed the same? What would you say that might be?
Okay, so some important answers to that. First of all, right now, modern esports people who promote modern esports, they think that they're inventing esports, you know. There's
right.
this delusion in their head. And also, as more and more opportunities for people to become spectators pop up, and there's a growing incredible growing spectator support base for the whole esports phenomena. They also think, oh, we invented spectator sport. Two of the things, to me, that are the commonality that has lasted through all the amazing technological changes: the interest in becoming a professional esports person that's so predominant nowadays to the degree that colleges are embracing that and making it part of their curriculum.
Yes.
That's how big of it is, that it's even entered, like, in my hometown, they have an esports team on the high school, and all the other high schools are developing esports teams. Major league sports teams are developing an esports affiliate that might travel with their team when they go from city to city to play other franchises, and like NBA, NHL, stuff like that. So, in other words, the incredible interest in esports is not new. It's the technology that allowed it to flourish to this amazing level. But all the champions who were part of my organization almost 40 years ago, Twin Galaxies is 40 years old in a few months. 40 years ago, they always believed that someday they would be professional video game players, and that it was going to support them, and that it was going to be their future that they desired. So in other words, this incredible devotion to esports stuff that's going on today, that same spirit existed from the very beginning. It's just that the technology wasn't there available to support that opportunity. So many of those players said, you know, I was just born 30 years ahead of my time. But I believed in it, I wanted it, and that's my expectation, that I was going to become a professional video game player. So have you ever seen that photograph of all those players posing in the street that was in Life magazine?
Yeah.
The famous photograph?
Yeah.
All those guys firmly were devoted to the idea of becoming esports superstars, and that's what they were going to do for the rest of their life. But they were 35 years ahead of time.
Right.
And that's what it was. So that's one of the main things that remained the same, in that the spirit for esports was always there from the beginning, and the modern group of esports people didn't invent that.
Right.
That's not new. It's the technology that's new, that allows foundations and platforms to exist, that allows esports to flourish on the level it's flourishing. The second thing that's so amazing is the spectator sport. Back in 1981, if Billy Mitchell, the famous Pac-Man player and Donkey Kong player, if the technology had been available and all the arcades could have plugged in to a broadcast coming from Twin Galaxies, where one of the champions, especially Billy Mitchell or those other guys, for Donkey Kong or Pac-Man or Galaga, 50,000 arcades would have subscribed and would have been on that feed that night.
Right, yeah.
Where Billy Mitchell goes for the Donkey Kong world record. Because when you were the top player in your arcade, 50,000, 75,000 different arcades, and you were putting up a real high score in a game, before you knew it, there were a couple people watching. And then before you knew it even further, there's 20 people watching. Because the seed was already there, the impulse was already there, the tendency was already there, that the public, the people, the other people in the arcade loved to watch championship level play when given the opportunity. So a crowd would always gather around those superstars way back then. In other words, the amazing spectator sport that's being generated now was always there in spiritual form.
Yeah.
It just never had an outlet. It never had a venue. It never had an infrastructure, a nervous system with which to flow and expand and have the opportunity to watch the champions do their scores. So those two are the main things. Two spiritual things. People believed in esports, and spectators wanted to watch esports. From the very beginning that the first quarter was dropped in the first video game, people wanted to watch great play. And what happened during that time? The technology expanded so much that anybody anywhere in the world could play anybody else anywhere in the world, and that the technology would allow it to be a high resolution, real time, space time, and also determine and verify that they are indeed playing correctly, and that, you know, all those kind of factors would be. But what made it more interesting was that the technology allowed potential sponsors to get involved and support it and advertise their products. And because the technology could actually determine how many eyeballs saw their ads and how many people clicked through and actually purchased. Once that incredible technology was available for the process of merchandising, these people knew that this was the place to advertise as opposed to a hard
print
magazine. Because who knows the response to a print magazine, really. But when you have the ability to determine in real time how many people are seeing your stuff and how many people are clicking through and ordering, that made it a no-brainer for them to put all the money behind esports and get very involved. And it sort of lowered the bar, too, because it meant that there's always sponsors. So therefore, you can start just a grassroots organization and still have lots of sponsors because there's so many people willing to get on board and support your products and put money up to support your different venue or your contest or your league or whatever it is. So with that incredible technology, things could be verified on a new level, things could be publicized on a new level, and everybody could face everybody else, and that made a whole new ball game, but still utilizing the same old spiritual things of people want to be esports stars and people want to watch esports stars. Does that make sense as an answer?
It does, yeah, that's brilliant. And you started out as a businessman, if I'm not mistaken, it was some oil, some real estate, things like that, if I remember. But you obviously have that businessman acumen. Did you know when you got Twin Galaxies and everything like that, this is the future, arcade, gaming, this is the future?
And we'll pause once again, take another quick commercial break, come back and continue our chat with video game legend Walter Day. Please stand by.
This is Matt King, the voice of Illidan Demon Hunter, and you're listening to Geek to Me Radio.
Welcome back to Geek to Me Radio. I was just recently at Planet Comic Con in Kansas City, and one of the things I love at these conventions is I'll go there specifically to talk to like a couple of people and get some interviews and whatnot, and of course to pick up some things for myself and, you know, meet some people who I've always wanted to meet. And Walter Day being there was a surprise. I was like, oh my gosh, Walter Day's here. I didn't look at the calendar, I guess, or who was on the event sheet or whatever, but this guy is a legend. If you are into video gaming at all, Walter Day's name has come up. Lots of documentaries he's been in and things like that, founder of Twin Galaxies, but it just a fascinating guy, and I'm sorry we had such a short time because I probably could have talked to him for the whole hour that we were there, but it was a great time to talk to him, and he was there with Retro Gaming Magazine. We were chatting with him about his business savvy. And if all his business savvy let him kind of predict, like, did he know that esports would blow up and how big the video game industry would become?
I have to tell you the secret behind the backstory.
Yeah.
Believe it or not, you hear me talk about meditation. I talk about it a lot now, even more. I was practicing transcendental meditation 2 times a day. You do it 20 minutes in the morning, you do it 20 minutes in the evening. And it's famous for making your head clearer and your brain sharper and more creative. I just had all these incredible creativity ideas about how to do all that stuff from just sitting down and meditating 2 times a day.
Meditate. See, people, that's the living proof.
Transcendental meditation. I have to be frank that that's where all this stuff came from. But as soon as I saw the first people do the first high scores with the crowds around them, I immediately cognized this whole thing and saw this is what it's all about and this is the future of it. And I just took step after step after step and started recording scores, created the Twin Galaxies scoreboard, founded, you know, the Twin Galaxies arcade, and then took it on the road and made it the definitive esports organization in history. That's why a lot of people consider me the father of esports. That was the first esports organization for competitive esports. There were 3 or 4 contests before I started Twin Galaxies, but they were just one-ups. Twin Galaxies was actually a comprehensive program that crowned the champions, created the rules, enforced the rules, honored the champions, created contests, all that stuff. No one had done it before. So that's why many people consider Twin Galaxies the birthplace of organized, competitive esports.
And rightly so, rightly so.
Yeah.
With all the games out there, you ran this on the ground floor. When you look back, if you personally had to say your top 5 favorite arcade, console games, whatever, what do you know what they're off the top of your head? Would it require some deep thought?
Well, I know which ones were the greatest ones. You know how you go up an on-ramp and you suddenly merge into traffic?
Yeah.
I suddenly found myself, upon becoming the scorekeeper, And suddenly, overnight, everybody was looking to Twin Galaxies to be their scorekeeper. It happened overnight, literally. Suddenly, I found out there's a huge competition for who's the best on Pac-Man. A huge worldwide competition for who's the best on Donkey Kong. A huge worldwide competition for who's the best on Defender and Missile Command and Asteroids. And every day, somewhere, we would be in the news as we adjudicated and said, this is the new world record on Defender. There were times when the record on Defender changed like 3 times in a single day.
Wow.
Because there could be 100 different arcades all having their local champion go for the world record. And the world record would creep up and creep up and creep up and creep up. And the same with Pac-Man. We had the deal with Pac-Man. We had to deal with Defender. We had to deal with Galaga. We had to deal with Centipede. There were all these, Missile Command. There were all these attempts because people loved to see champions get high scores. And the arcades and the media were so intrigued by it all that when someone at a local arcade got a high score, which broke a new world record, they would do feature stories on the
right.
Big, tremendous amount of print would be devoted to this new champion who just got this high score on a game. And so there's a period there where I could see that Twin Galaxies was in the news every single day, someplace. And that's because we would be integral to the story, because we're officially proclaiming that, yes, this is indeed the hot top score, or this is the third highest score. And so we were part of the structure of all these stories again and again and again and again and again, which made Twin Galaxies the crossroads of the video game
age. Sure, yeah.
Because people began to come there to play in front of me in person.
Right.
It was very interesting. So it became a mecca for video game play.
It's like coming to play, coming to the Godfather to, beg a favor. You're playing in front of Walter Day.
Some of the media used to refer to us as the Dodge City of video games because the fast guns would come to show off their skills.
Right, yeah, it makes sense.
It's pretty amazing.
If you had to point to something that has changed gaming, in your opinion, not for the best, what is there something you can point to that isn't?
Well, if we want to get to the downside of everything, it's a very eroding for people's health to be into video games too much. Consumption of too much sugar, consumption of too much caffeine, maybe even drugs, even though that doesn't help you think clearly as the gamer. And also staying up all night sleeping during the day.
Yeah.
That erodes the health in a tremendous way. So when parents are involved, parents aren't doing a good job right now in most cases. So parents have got to really rein their kids in because it's detrimental to their health and their psychological well-being. So that's the downside of things. And then of course they say, are the violent video games going to have an effect? Well, everything has an effect somewhere. So violent video games probably aren't going to be helpful, especially if the person is hair triggered, balanced, and they already have a lot of psychological or emotional issues that they're bringing to the table. But the most maybe amazing thing is that Ready Player One, who knows how many more years before there is a big global oasis. The technology is getting closer and closer and closer. The computer strength and bandwidth is getting closer, closer, closer. So that it's very, very possible that in 20 years, 15 years, 30 years, who knows when it'll happen, there'll be a tremendous common place that people can go to and then have tremendous bandwidth so they have real-time participation. So that's very possible. Very possible. And all sorts of accessories, all sorts of VR, things like that. And things you run on so you can have the simulated experience of running and moving through an environment. So all that stuff clearly we're being directed to. And it's like the space age. NASA did a less than adequate job of moving us to the stars because they become budget restricted. It's almost like they lost the spirit.
Yeah, yeah.
But once it suddenly segued over to the realm of industry and billionaires, things really started taking off.
Right, yeah.
Because in the old days, NASA and maybe 4 or 5 other space agencies, they were pioneering the development of space technology. Now you have hundreds, maybe even thousands of companies all working on different areas of space age technology, space travel. And they're all sharing information on the internet. It's just like any growth of knowledge. In the old days, maybe in the 1870s, where, let's say there were 1,000 laboratories in the world that were doing original scientific research. Now there's probably 2 or 3 million laboratories in the world that are moving the body of knowledge forward, and they're sharing it in journals immediately and online immediately, so that the knowledge base is expanding faster, as is space technology expanding faster. So in that same way, the technology of gaming is expanding faster, because everybody's building on each other's shoulders. So it's going to be pretty, pretty fast and pretty, pretty amazing.
My very last question for you, I don't want to take up too much more of your time. You mentioned Ready Player One. Do you have a favorite video game movie? Any movie that's based on a video game that you like best or really thought was well done?
Well, I enjoyed Man vs. Snake. I really like Ready Player One. I could actually watch it. I've watched it twice. I don't commonly watch movies twice. Actually, I'm beginning to forget movies and go and see them a few months later and can't remember any of it.
That's great. It's like you're seeing it for the first time again. That's great.
I mean, I just did that with The Queen's Gambit.
Oh, really?
Have you seen that?
Yeah, that was great. The chess game, I love that. So good.
Unbelievably good. I mean, I just finished watching it for the third time, and I was pleased that I couldn't remember a lot of the parts. And I don't think I'm getting Alzheimer's or anything. It's just the way the memory works, you know?
Yeah. There's so much content, too. You're absorbing so much content with all the streaming services.
And I can't believe how many things I suddenly see that, wow, I didn't see that the first time. I didn't see that the second time. Another science fiction movie I've watched about 3 times that I'm surprised by how much I enjoyed is Tom Cruise's Edge of Tomorrow. To me, it's one of the most tightly well-done, intriguing science fiction movies ever.
This has been absolutely fantastic. Thank you for your time, Walter Day. He's here at Planet Comic Con.
Thank you.
Thanks for your time.
I'm glad you like my answers.
Of course. I loved them. Thank you.
Thank you.
That's gonna do it. Another show in the books. Thanks again to my guests, Joel Soisson and Walter Day. Thanks, as always, to Joey V making this sound as good as it does every week. I could not do this without him. And thank you all listening. Thank you very much for tuning in and subscribing each week. If you haven't subscribed, make sure you do so. And also, if you wouldn't mind, go to geektomeradio.com. That's kind of our homepage, the launching pad for all the stuff we do. And play around there for a while. The more you play around on my website, the greater that helps me with search engine optimization. And please, 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 if you have not already, go to youtube.com, find Geek to Me Radio, subscribe there. We're trying to boost our subscriptions. I'd love to get to 500 here before the end of the third quarter. So if you could do that for me, I would greatly appreciate it. If you're not already following me on Instagram and Twitter at Geek to Me Radio, that would also be helpful. Well, when you go to YouTube, make sure you subscribe, hit the little bell notification so you're notified every time a show drops. We put our live shows up there as well. We are shows live on the Big 550 KTRS every Sunday night, 10 p.m. Eastern and 7 p.m. Pacific. So if you'll get notifications for those as well. Thank you for all your support. Thank you to my guests. Thank you to Joey V. And until next week, my friends.
It's not in the way you watch I sound be. It's not in the way you watch the Flash. It's not in the way you love Scotty Young Art. It's not in the way you play Mario Kart. It's not in the way you look when you make Game of Thrones references. That's a show. This is Geek Too. That's a show!
Thank you, Raccoon City. Good night.
Hey, kids. Are your parents about to buy you a shiny new toy from Amazon?
Hi, I'm Chucky. Wanna play?
Well, don't be selfish. Share some of that money with us. Before going on Amazon, make sure to type in bit.ly/geektome in the web browser. It will look just like Amazon.com, except it'll say referral Geek to Me Radio up top. And then when you check out, a tiny percentage will go to support the show without costing you 1 cent more. So before your parents get you that gizmo, gadget, or widget, make sure they type in bit.ly/geektome in the web browser.
bit.ly/geektome, bit.ly/geektome.